aired, the Department of Children and Families filed a Care and Protection case, or 51A, as they call it, on behalf of Marjorie. The report was screened out, meaning her case was dropped because the claims against your parents were not considered abuse or neglect under the law. The filing of the 51A was later leaked to the public after Marjorie's and your parents' deaths. Rachel stops and looks at me. I say, "It's okay. Keep going. I know that you were pulled out of school and that your parents hired a private tutor." "Yeah, Stephen Graham Jones." Funny that I remember his full name like that, but that's how he was introduced to me. He wouldn't let me call him Mr. like my regular teachers, and I liked saying his whole name out loud whenever I could. It became a little OCD tick of mine. I'd say, "Goodbye, Stephen Graham Jones," or, "I don't know what an obtuse triangle is, Stephen Graham Jones." Rachel laughs. "His name does roll off the tongue, doesn't it?" "It does. He was this short, skinny grad student with huge eyes and terribly crooked teeth. Wow, I haven't thought about him in a long time. I only remember meeting with him a handful of times. I remember that for a tutor, he wasn't very good at math. I have no idea where my parents found him." We both smile and drink amiable sips of our coffee. "What else do you have?" Rachel turns some pages in her notebook. "I have the Nielsen ratings for each episode. The final episode pulled a stunning 20 share. Maybe I'll go back and mention that in my blog." She says, "I have a printout of the antipsychotics prescribed to Marjorie, which include Clozaril and Fanapt. When I had a friend who knows what she's looking for dig through the police report, however, those drugs didn't come up in the toxicology screening." I have no idea if Marjorie was taking her meds. I think Mom was taking her own stuff. Scratch that. I know Mom was taking her own stuff. So, she really wasn't all there. And Dad, he still wanted to cure Marjorie with prayers, of course. He'd started spending a lot of time down in the basement by himself. Maybe on the days the visiting psychiatrist was there, Marjorie took her meds, but the other days, who knows? Those days when it was just us, everyone just sort of floated around the house, and only occasionally would we bump into each other. I spent a lot of time outside by myself. Dinner was takeout or delivery most nights. Rachel nods. "Included in the police report is a printout of emails that your father and the pastor of that Baptist church from Kansas exchanged for a period of 1 month." "He was the same protester Dad punched out, right?" "That's correct. And that same guy was arrested 3 years ago on..." I interrupt her. "Do you have those emails with you? Can I see them?" Rachel looks at me. She's been looking at me the whole time, yes, but now she's looking at me like I'm an object to be carefully observed. Or maybe she's worried that if she takes her eyes off of me, I'll disappear. She doesn't think I should read the emails. I won't push her if she resists, but she doesn't. She slides the folder with the printouts across the table to me. The first emails from the church leader featured the same hate-filled slogans that graced their protest signs. Dad's initial responses are typed in all caps, full of profanity and physical threats. But as the emails continue, there's a subtle and slow shift toward a dialogue. Dad tries arguing theology and scripture with the other man, which becomes Dad blaming Father Wanderley, who had forsaken him, and the Catholic Church for failing and abandoning him and his family, which becomes Dad also blaming the television show producers who duped him into believing what he was doing was for the best, which became Dad lashing out at his former employers, politicians, the economy, modern society, and American culture, which eventually became Dad asking for help and for advice from this other frothing lunatic of a man who never once offered a single word of love or comfort or support, and only said that God was unhappy with Dad, unhappy with the whole family. Sent 3 days before the poisoning, the pastor's last email ended with, "John, you know what you have to do." I say, "My God." I give her back the printouts, and my hands are shaking. Rachel reaches across the table to hold my hands, but I pull away and hide them under the table. She says, "Sorry, should we stop? Do you need a break? Should we go somewhere else to talk?" "No, it's okay. Thank you. Nothing personal, but I just want to get this part of it over with." The barista makes a brief reappearance behind the counter, as if he can sense some emotional storm that calls for a soothing $7 scone and equally overpriced latte. He asks if we would like anything else. We tell him no thank you, but then I ask him if he can turn down the heat. He shrugs, and while backing away from us, he says, "I can't control the heat in this crazy place. I wish I could, believe me." After he leaves, I say, "So they never found where Dad got the potassium cyanide from, right? They thought it was from some jeweler who was a member of that Baptist church or something?" Rachel says, "Jewelers use potassium cyanide for gilding and buffing. I did talk to a detective who worked on this case, and she said they first tried every jewelry shop and jeweler supply house in New England, and when those inquiries turned up empty, they tried chemical suppliers and sales reps from all across the country. Nothing. There were tons of online places he could have ordered it from, but they didn't find anything relating to cyanide on the family PC's hard drive. They never found any suspicious charges to his credit cards or PayPal account. All they found were the emails to the church leader. One of the higher-ranking members of the church was Paul Quentin, who ran a jewelry store in Penobscot, Kansas. They couldn't find any evidence that Quentin supplied your father or anyone else with potassium cyanide. The detective told me it was surprisingly easy to get that stuff back then, so it could have come from anywhere. But to this day, she thinks the pastor in Kansas had it sent to your father somehow." My head starts to fill with fuzz, like my brain was a radio and the dial was just spun to a dead station. I ask, "Can you tell me what the report says about fingerprints?" Rachel looks at me quizzically. "Fingerprints?" I wave my hand around like I'm impatiently shooing away a fly. "Can I just read the report? Do you have time for that?" Rachel says, I think so. It's rather long." She passes the thick manila envelope across the table. "I don't want to read the report right now. I don't know why I asked to do so. Maybe I just wanted to see what her reaction would be. Sitting here in the coffee shop with her outlining her research findings, I'm getting the sense that she's hiding something from me. I don't know how that would be possible. She wasn't there when it happened, and I was." I push the report back across the table to her, and I say, "I remember my last day with my family. I remember our last day together. I do," as though I'm trying to convince myself that I'm telling the truth. "I'm going to tell you about it as quickly as I can." Chapter 25. It was Saturday afternoon, 6 days until Christmas. I'd been promised that we were going to put up a Christmas tree, a real one, on that day. But Mom hadn't gotten out of bed until super late and announced that we would get a tree on Sunday instead. I was mad. So mad I went and hid in my bedroom. I decided I wasn't going to talk to anyone the rest of the day. I made signs instead. If Mom or Dad asked me something, I'd just hold up my sign with a simple message answer. The signs were nothing fancy. I used lined notebook paper and a blue pen. I made the following signs: "No." "Good." "What's for dinner?" "Yes." "I don't know." "Read it." "Milk." "Water." "Cookie?" "I'm fine." "When are we getting a tree?" "I'll talk then." "Where?" "Can I go outside?" "Play soccer." "I already read." "Nothing." "TV?" "Too early." "In my room." "No bath." "No shower." "I'm not tired. I can hear you. Please don't yell. Bigfoot is standing outside the window." I lay on my bed, practice answering imaginary questions with my signs, shuffling through my pile of papers looking for the intended responses. While I attempted to construct what I thought would be a logical, easy-to-remember card cataloging system, I heard an approaching clunking, and another piece of paper, this one folded in half, slid under my door and into my room. It was a note from Marjorie. "Come into my room now. I need to show you something. This is so important, like life and death important, Miss Mary." Since returning home from the hospital, Marjorie had kept to herself and generally stayed out of trouble. She hadn't liked trying to get around in her walking boot much, and going up and down the stairs was especially difficult, so Dad had put a new TV in her room. He'd hung it on the freshly plastered wall adjacent to her bed. Her TV stayed on almost constantly, a drone of voices at low volume echoed in the hallway until it was time for lights out, and Dad would go into her room and shut the TV off himself. Late at night, there'd been occasional bouts of her talking or even whispering loudly to herself, her words and sentences always just out of reach. I don't remember if Mom or Dad went into her room to try to comfort her or quiet her down, or if they stayed in their room, content to pretend what we were hearing was Marjorie's television. Either way, the nocturnal outbursts were mild compared to what they used to be, and they didn't last very long. The next morning, Marjorie would be as quiet as a painting all over again. I read Marjorie's note 3 times. Despite everything that I'd gone through, that our whole family had gone through, I felt that old excitement, that familiar flutter in my stomach. Marjorie wanted to spend time with me. I don't think I can ever fully explain the power she had over the 8-year-old me, or the power she still has over me. I folded up the note and stuck it underneath my mattress. I ripped one more piece of paper out of the notebook and quickly made another sign. More stories? Her bedroom door was open, and I peeked in. The TV was off and her computer was on, but she wasn't at her desk or on her bed. Marjorie popped out from behind the door, said, "Quick," and then grabbed my arm, pulled me in, and shut the door behind me. I nearly jumped out of my sneakers and yelped like a puppy accidentally getting her paw stepped on, but I didn't drop my signs. "Shh, sorry, sorry, didn't mean to scare you. Is Dad home? Did he see you come in?" Marjorie loomed over me, and I wondered if she'd gotten taller and I'd gotten shorter somehow. She wore purple pajama pants and a black hooded sweatshirt. She had on one fuzzy blue bunny slipper, the one with the floppy ears that threatened to trip her at any moment. I didn't know where Dad was. I assumed he was down in the basement doing whatever it was he did when he was down there. I hadn't been in the basement since the last time with Marjorie. I held up my "I don't know" sign. "Not talking?" Pleased and vindicated that my Marjorie understood me right away, I shuffled through the deck and then held up "yes." Marjorie smiled. "That's fine, monkey. We can work with this, I think, yeah. Hey, do you remember my story about the growing things? Do you remember the 2 sisters in the cabin and the father who killed their mother and buried her in the basement?" I held up "yes" and nodded my head hard enough that it could have fallen off. "I told you that story as a warning, okay? Something that could actually happen." I looked for an appropriate sign to use, but didn't have one. I sighed. I wanted to say, "I know, you've told me that 1,000 times. I thought about showing her my "Bigfoot is standing outside the window" sign to try to make her laugh, but it didn't feel like the right time. "I'm not fooling around now. I need you to read some more stories. I need you to think really hard about them. And I need you to understand." Marjorie looked all around the room as though making sure that no one else was watching us. "They're not good stories, but they're important stories, and I promise they're true stories. All of them are true. They actually happened. Okay?" She led me to her desk and the computer. She called up the browser, went into her bookmarks folder, and clicked on one of the links. At the top of the web page, white capital letters BBC were block outlined in red. Marjorie said, "Here, read this story." It was about a man who, after being laid off by his longtime employer, shot his wife and his two kids. Then he burned himself up along with their house. I held up my "More Stories" sign because I knew that was what she wanted. "Yes, there are more. So many more. Read this one." This was about another man. His wife had just divorced him. He had been in contact with a protest group called Fathers for Justice. On Father's Day, he connected a hose to his Land Rover's tailpipe and ran it through the back window. He parked in the middle of an empty field, and he and his two children died because of carbon monoxide poisoning. "Read." I read about another man who'd poisoned himself and his children after his wife had left him. And then I read about another man who jumped off a bridge with his kids in his arms. And then I read about another man who drove into a lake with his kids locked in his car and strapped into their car seats. There were more and more and more. Marjorie clicked to a new link whenever I looked away from the screen and up at her. There were so many, I stopped reading and just pretended to read. I didn't have to read everything, though. The stories were there in the bold headlines and pictures of the fathers and their wives and their smiling children, always smiling, and their houses and apartments and cars and backyards strung with yellow police tape. And I remember thinking that all these stories started off sounding like the old fairy tales Mom and Dad used to tell me. And instead of witches putting kids in ovens and evil queens conjuring poisoned apples, the fathers and husbands were the monsters doing the unspeakable things to their families. And these stories all ended without anyone saving anybody. No one was saved. I couldn't believe there were so many stories like that, and that people would choose to read them. I turned away from the computer. It was too much. Way too much. I crumpled up the "More Stories" sign and dropped it to the floor. I flipped over my "I'm fine" sign and wrote, "Why?" She spun me around and put her hands on the arms of the desk chair, caging me in. Her face was only inches from mine, and it looked as big as the moon. She calmly launched into a long, rambling spiel, the gist of which was about how she'd read these stories after finding something called the Howard Journal of Criminal Justice. After conducting a decade-long study, the journal had outlined the types of men most likely to murder their families. These men all blamed the breakdown of their once ideal family on something outside their control, something outside themselves. Some blamed their family's problems on their lack of economic success and or his not being the breadwinner for the family. I remember when she said breadwinner that I pictured Dad winning a giant loaf of bread in some sort of carnival-like contest. Many fathers blamed their wives for pitting their own children against them. Some men believed the entire family itself was to blame because they didn't act the right way. They weren't following his traditional religious values and customs. And there were the men who thought that they were actually saving or protecting the family from some outside threat or force. Marjorie stopped and backed away from the chair. I held up my new "Why" sign again. She said, "Don't you get it? Everything I've said and you've read, they describe what's going on with Dad. He's going to do something like that to us. To all of us." I carefully picked through my signs and held up "No." Marjorie said, "I know you love him, and I love him too, I do. And I know it's hard to believe, but there's something wrong with him. He's sick. It's so obvious. Haven't you figured it out yet? He's why I put us through everything, Mary. I knew he was getting sick, so at first I faked that I was sick so that someone would figure out that Dad was the one who needed help." Marjorie knelt down in front of my chair, and the hard plastic boot on her right foot clunked on the floor. She folded her hands over one of my knees and rested her chin there, so I had to look down at her. I shook my head and held up my no sign. She told me that all of her sessions with Dr. Hamilton were really about Dad and what she thought he was going to do to all of us. I tried holding up my no sign again, but I accidentally held up the good sign. She told me that she tried telling Mom, but Mom wouldn't listen to any of it. So Marjorie pretended to be beyond sick, to be possessed, in order to make Mom finally listen and pay attention. I held up more signs, random signs, anything to get her to stop talking. Marjorie told me that when the unexpected opportunity of the TV show happened, she thought for sure that everyone would see who was really sick and who needed to be saved, only it didn't work that way. During the exorcism, she was so frightened and confused by what they did and tried to do to her. She wanted out, wanted literally to jump out of the family and out of the whole situation. So she jumped. She continued to talk, and I was crying, and I tried to cover my face with my signs. I was so tired of her filling my head with her stories, filling my head with her ghosts. I found a pen in her desk drawer and tried to write, "I don't believe you," before she took the pen out of my hand. Marjorie said, "Mary, stop. Listen. Forget everything else I just said. I have proof about Dad. I'll take you down to the basement later if you want so you can see for yourself." She stopped talking, pulled my hands away from the signs and held them, trapped them in hers. She said, "He's created this big, weird shrine down there with drop cloths hanging on either side of the big metal cross that the show let him keep. Remember that ugly thing? He's got other pictures down there, too, leaning against the foundation walls, and I guess they're religious or, you know, show some scenes from the Bible, but they're awful, terrible, scary-looking scenes, with some bearded guys in robes holding knives and sheep bleeding and screaming and, I don't know, just weird stuff like that. He set up a little altar, too, using an old wooden bench. Listen, I found a small glass jar with a metal cap sitting on top of the bench, right out in the open and everything." Marjorie paused, looked around again, and dropped her voice into a whisper. "That small glass jar, it's full to the top with a white substance or powder, and it's, what's the word, granular. So, you know, it looks like a cross between sugar and flour. You know what sugar and flour look like, right?" I nodded. Marjorie stood up and turned my chair around slowly so I was again facing the computer. A picture of someone else's dead father was still there, and he leered at me. Marjorie clicked onto the search engine, typed in the phrase, "potassium cyanide," clicked images, and then the screen was full of pictures of jars and bags of white powder. She said, "This is the stuff. He's got this stuff downstairs. It's poison, Mary. He's going to poison us all. And soon." I sat and stared at the screen. I didn't know what to think anymore. So I let Marjorie think for me. Marjorie talked so fast I could barely keep up with her. She whispered in my ear, filling me up with more stories. These were about Mom and Dad, stuff from before I was born or when I was so little I couldn't possibly remember. Some of the stories were nice. Some weren't so nice. They were the early stories of our family. There were stories about our parents taking us to playgrounds and letting us sit in their laps on the swings and slides, about us all walking to the dairy farm to see the cows and goats. There were graphically detailed stories about them loudly fucking each other in their bedroom and late at night on the living room couch and on the floor in front of the TV. There was a story about them drunkenly slapping each other in the face after a date night gone bad, with Mom kicking out a window in the back door as the final blow, and how the following week they went away for 2 days of marriage counseling. There were stories about simple day-to-day stuff, like Dad giving us horsey rides and being made to sing us songs at night before we went to sleep. There was a story about the time that Dad yanked Marjorie away from my crib because she was writing on my face with a marker and he accidentally pulled her arm out of her socket. And there was the time Mom started screaming wildly at 2-year-old me because I wouldn't uncover my ears for the eardrops I needed. Even though I don't remember any of it, I felt like I did. It felt like I was there and could see everything. Marjorie told her stories until the sun went down and her bedroom turned purple. Finally, she stopped and put a pen in my hand and flipped over one of my signs. She said, "Mom is getting sick, too. You know she is. She's breaking down and can't handle it. I've seen her down in the basement with him, praying, saying, and doing weird things. We have to do something before it's too late. We have to help them, have to save them. We'll do it by saving ourselves first. If we don't do anything, Dad will bury us all in the basement." I wrote, "What do we do?" Marjorie told me what we were going to do, and I made some new signs. I walked into the kitchen with my "What's for Dinner" sign held up in front of my chest. Mom sat by herself at the kitchen table. She smoked a cigarette and flipped through an entertainment magazine. She said, "What's this?" I pointed at the sign. "Are you not talking because we didn't get the tree?" Sign, "Yes." "What do you want for dinner, then? Do you have that written down on a sign?" My next sign, "Spaghetti." "We can do that." Sign, "Okay." "Do I get a kiss?" Sign, "Okay." I went back upstairs. I still hadn't seen Dad and assumed he was in the basement. I waited with Marjorie in her room. She let me keep one of her pens and a pocket-sized pad of paper, one with a glittery yellow cover, so I could write new signs more quickly. She also turned on her TV and let me watch SpongeBob. It was an episode that featured a pirate ghost that was big and green and kind of scary. Partway through the show, Marjorie dropped to all fours and stuck her arms under her bed. Her walking boot crashed heavily into the floor twice. She emerged with a glass jar of white powder that she'd told me about. Sign, "Is that it?" "Yes." Sign, "You said it was full?" The jar was taller and skinnier than I imagined, and it was only maybe a quarter full. Marjorie smiled. "Nothing gets by you at all, does it, Mary?" "It was full. I dumped most of it out." I let Marjorie walk down the stairs first. Her boot sounded like a bowling ball rolling down the stairs. When we reached the foyer, Marjorie surprised me by putting the jar into my hands. This wasn't part of the plan. I shook my head no and tried to give it back to her. She whispered, "This will only work if you do it. You heard me walking down the stairs, yeah? I'm just realizing now that she'll hear me clomping around the kitchen if I do it. Don't worry, I'll distract her for you. It'll be easy." Marjorie put two hands in the middle of my back and pushed me away and into the living room. She limped into the dining room. The dining room table was covered in clean clothes, as usual. Marjorie called out, "Hey, Mom? Can you help me find my purple PJ top? I can't find it, and I want to wear it tonight. It gets so cold in my room." Mom walked out of the kitchen and said, "Wait, hold on a second. Don't just go picking through all the piles. I killed myself folding everything." I wasn't going to do it. I wasn't going to do anything. I was just going to stand there in the living room with a cold glass jar in my hand and wait for someone to take it away from me. I swear, I don't remember walking from the living room and into the kitchen, and then next to the stove. But there I was. I don't remember if I had taken off the silver lid, or if Marjorie had done so for me. The blue gas flame of the burner was low. The sauce bubbled slowly. Mom and Marjorie bickered in the dining room. I poured white powder into the saucepan and quickly stirred until it disappeared into the red, until it looked as though I hadn't added anything. I did it because I believed in Marjorie, and I believed that her plan would work, that it would help everyone. I tiptoed out of the kitchen, and I heard Mom say to Marjorie in an exasperated voice, "Find it yourself, then." Mom said, "No sauce, right, sweetie?" I held up my yes sign. I used a fork to mix the butter into my plain pasta. Dad asked what all my signs were about. I held up my hastily scribbled cheese sign. Mom told him that I'd decided to stop talking for the day. She didn't tell him why. Dad passed me the Parmesan cheese. I don't remember where in the house Dad came from. What I mean is, I don't remember where he was before we were all in the kitchen eating dinner. I only remember him being there at the kitchen table, like he'd always been sitting there, like a gargoyle. He was hunched, and his unkempt beard jutted out in random places, and his eyes darted around the room like he was always looking for an emergency exit. Dad prayed silently to himself as Mom served herself a bowl of pasta and covered it with red sauce. The saucepan was avocado green and dinged up. It had been used a lot. Dad served himself when Mom was finished. Marjorie was the last to come to the table. She had been in the downstairs bathroom for a long time. She tickled my neck with freshly wet hands as she scooted by me and sat down. Using her fork instead of the wooden serving ladle, Marjorie speared a staggering amount of spaghetti onto her plate. It all clumped and stuck together like a ball of tangled yarn. Mom said, "Wow, someone's hungry." "I could eat the world. Mary, pass the sauce, please," Marjorie said, and winked at me. Her eyes were red, as if she'd been crying. I didn't know what to do or what her asking for the sauce meant, and when I looked around the table, I thought Mom and Dad were staring at me extra hard, like they knew I'd done something wrong. The empty glass jar Marjorie had given me was still in my sweatshirt pocket. My skin tingled with fear as I thought Marjorie had told them what I did to the sauce, had told them our plan, and had told them it was all my idea and my fault. I held up my no sign. Dad said,
"I got it."
He reached his big paw across the table and passed the saucepan to Marjorie. She said, "Thank you, Father," in her faux British accent, and poured the rest of the sauce onto her pasta. She twirled her fork in the middle of the red mess and shoved the glob into her mouth. She chewed, swallowed, and watched me watching her. The moment I saw the sauce pass between her lips, I was as angry as I'd ever been in my life. Marjorie had fooled me again. I'd believed her. Tears filled my eyes, so I kept my head down near my plate. She had lied to me, made it all up. Her theory about Dad, the family's stories, and our plan. Our plan: have Mom cook us spaghetti and we'd spike the sauce. I famously didn't like sauce, and Marjorie would say her stomach hurt, so she'd have her pasta plain just like me. We'd put enough of the powder in the sauce to just knock out, Marjorie's phrase, our parents, or make them sick enough so that we could then run away, escape the house. We'd bring the poison jar to the police as proof of what Dad had planned to do to us, and then we'd be safe. Dad would get taken away, yes, but he'd also get the help he needed, and maybe someday he'd be well enough to come back home to us, just like how every time Marjorie was sent away, she came back to us. This made sense to the 8-year-old me. People went away, and they came back, and would continue to come back because they had always done so previously. So it was clear that Marjorie had tricked me into pouring a mix of sugar and flour into the sauce. I was the dummy again, right? I mean, why else would she eat the sauce too? I held up my Y sign to her. Marjorie said, "This is the best sauce ever. You should have some, monkey." She was laughing at me behind her big red smile. I hated her so much right then. I whispered it as I chewed on my plain pasta so no one else could hear me, but I did. I whispered, "I hate you." I wish you were dead. Marjorie said, You eat pizza with sauce. You love pizza. I don't understand why you don't eat it with your spaghetti. It's crazy. Right, Dad?
Dad said, Whatever. I've long given up trying to figure anyone out.
Mom said, Leave her alone. She'll eat sauce when she wants to. My sister and my parents talking about my not eating red sauce were their last words. No explanations or realizations or regrets or pleas for forgiveness. No goodbyes. And it happened quickly. I still can't believe it happened so quickly. The high-pitched scritch of forks rubbing against the ceramic dishes stopped. Breaths became heavy and as loud as and infrequent as whale spouts. Chairs groaned, slid back. Hands dropped forks and squished into their plates. Glasses knocked over. My stack of signs slid to the floor. Elbows banged on the table, legs kicked out, eyes fluttered and closed, heads dropped, bodies slouched and sank. I stood up and backed away from the table slowly, initially afraid that a sudden movement from me would make the scene implode further, with a table and chairs and everyone sliding and sinking into the basement. Mom's and Dad's heads lay on the table as though they were school children napping on their desks. I tried poking Mom in the shoulder, and her arm dropped below the table. I jumped back, banging into the counter and the rack of dishes behind me, and no one reacted. No one moved. I screamed as loudly as I could and paced the room. Marjorie's head was tilted back, face pointed at the ceiling. Her hair had fallen out of her ponytail and hung down behind her, a half-drawn curtain. Red saliva bubbled out of her mouth and dripped down the length of her long, white neck. Her eyes were half open. I stood next to her on my tiptoes and craned my face over hers. I said her name 3 times. I didn't use my signs. I asked her what we were supposed to do now. Her eyes were dark and reflected the light above her. Her skin had turned to clay. I asked her how long it would take for the powder to wear off. I asked her how long it would take them to wake up. I told her that this was a bad idea, that she didn't have to eat the sauce like they did. I told her I needed her, and I didn't think I could go to the police by myself because I didn't know where they were. I put the empty glass jar in Marjorie's hand, wrapped her fingers around it, tried to make her hold it like she was supposed to. But it kept falling out, so I took it back. I sat in my chair and waited. None of them was breathing. I stood up, covered my eyes, and told Mom and Dad that I was sorry I played such a mean prank on them, that it was all Marjorie's fault. I started crying. I went down into the basement. I was terrified. But I had to see what was down there, see if anything that Marjorie had told me was true. I ran down the basement stairs. I wanted extra light with me, so I carried 2 jumbo flashlights, and the beams danced and bounced off the stone foundation walls. There was no shrine with tapestries and pictures and altars. There was none of that. Up against the back wall of the basement, next to the shelves of food, there was the giant pewter cross that had briefly hung on the wall in Marjorie's room. A dirty rag covered Jesus' head. His body was tarnished and smeared with dirt. I sat on the basement floor, and I waited for Marjorie's growing things to come bursting out of the ground, wrap me in their green tentacles, and pull me underneath the house, or pull me apart, piece by piece, bit by bit, until every part of me had been torn away. Everything gets foggy after the basement. Chapter 26. What I remember is going to the second floor and leaving everyone's bedroom door open in case they wanted to come upstairs. I left my door open so they could find me. I had my Richard Scarry book and the empty poison jar with me. I was in my bedroom 3 days later when Auntie Erin came over to the house and found me. Found us. Rachel says, "Mary," and holds up her hand to stop me. But I'm not done talking. Not yet. But apparently that last part didn't happen. I know I sort of insinuated before that I hadn't read the police report, but I've read the police report. So I know that Marjorie's psychiatrist came by for her appointment, found cars in the driveway, a locked house, and called the police after no one answered the door or the phone. I know the police broke in and found me in the kitchen with my family. I know that I was underneath the kitchen table. I know I was sitting in the filth and foul of three-day-old bodies, and I know I was sitting down at the foot of my mother, leaning up against her legs, sitting there with her thumb in my mouth. I finally stop talking, for what feels like the first time in days, and take a deep, greedy breath. I'm not crying, but I am trembling all over. My hands wiggle in my lap like dying fish. I'm cold and reach for my jacket. I say, "Is it me, or is it now totally freezing in here?" Rachel stands up and slides her chair over next to me so that she can put an arm around my shoulder and hug me. I lean into her. She's warm and comfortable. I close my eyes and we sit like that until Rachel lets me go. She wipes her eyes with a napkin from the table. I say, "That memory of Auntie Erin coming into my bedroom, saving me, carrying me downstairs to her car, it has faded a little, but it's still there. Only it's been reassigned or shuffled off to be part of another more appropriate memory of the years spent living with my amazing aunt. Maybe it's not the same as actually remembering, but what the police report describes as having happened in terrible detail, I can see it now. And I can almost feel it." Rachel says, "I wish I knew what to say, Mary." I've never told anyone what I've admitted to you. The police, psychologists, my aunt, no one. I imagine there'll be a giant shitstorm when it comes out in the book. But I think I'm ready for it. I'm ready to live with the truth anyway. Rachel writes something down in her notebook and lets loose a long sigh. She says, "Wow, Mary, you break my heart and I don't know what to do now." "What do you mean?" Rachel slips into her coat and says, "It has gotten cold in here, hasn't it?" She opens and closes her notebook twice. "What is the truth, Mary? And please, I don't mean that to sound accusatory or in any way callous to the horror you lived through, that you live with. It's just, given what I knew, or what I thought I knew going into this, and what I read and researched, and now heard from you, I'm not at all sure what really happened." I say, "There are days it all seems like something that happened to someone else, and in a way, that's the truth. I haven't been that little Miss Mary in a very long time. There are days when I want to believe it was all some horror movie that I've watched repeatedly, and in that horror movie, a demon inside Marjorie magically made the poison appear under the bed, and it was the demon that tricked an innocent child into killing her family. There are days when I want to believe that Dad only got the potassium cyanide because he was desperate to polish up that ugly pewter cross in the basement. There are days when I like to think that Marjorie was right and that she truly believed in the plan she pitched me, but mistakenly thought the supposedly smaller amount of poison in the jar wouldn't be enough to kill them. Most days, I really don't know what to think or believe. All that I do know with 100% certainty is that Marjorie and perhaps my father were very sick. Our entire family was put under impossible stresses and strains. We were all manipulated, and we were all irrational, maybe even willingly so. And when I was 8 years old, I was manipulated into poisoning my sister and my parents. We sit in silence. A young, giggling couple bursts into the coffee shop, slamming the front door open. The bell rings angrily. They both make loud, "Brr, we're freezing" noises as they walk toward the counter. The barista reappears. He rubs his hands and arms furiously, trying to keep them warm. He sees me watching, winks, and says, "Heat's off, but it wasn't me." Rachel starts in with questions about the police report, about there being some inconsistencies regarding my story and some of the gathered evidence, including the glass jar. She says that most of the prints on the jar were smudged and unreadable, and the only partial they could lift belonged to my father. "Yes, I'd read that about the prints, but I don't know what else to tell you about the jar. I told you everything I know and everything I remember. Anything else would be speculation or two-bit detective work on my part. I've given you everything that I have to give regarding my story. The rest is really up to you. You wanted my story. Now you have it, and I trust you with it." I stand up slowly and say, "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sound snippy. I really do mean it when I say that I trust you with this story. If anyone is going to write it, I'm so very glad it's you, Rachel." Rachel smiles, stands, and says, "Mary," I interrupt. "I'm exhausted and suddenly not feeling that great. I think I need to go home and lie down now, okay?" "Yes, of course. You need to take care of yourself, Mary." We share a long hug. We declare ourselves friends. Rachel offers to give me a ride home. I politely refuse and tighten the belt of my red coat. Rachel puts on her gloves and wraps a scarf around her neck. She promises to check in with me after she gets back from Amsterdam. She says that we should have dinner or lunch together sometime, and not to talk at all about the book. I tell her that I would like that very much, but I doubt the just-for-fun lunch dinner will happen. She'll be too busy writing our book, and busy with interviews and assignments for her new one. And despite how friendly and motherly she's being, the way she looks at me now, it's different. Behind the counter, the barista is on the phone with someone and grumbling about the heat not working. I turn and walk toward the front door, thinking that it must not have shut all the way after the couple entered because of how cold it is in the coffee shop now. Rachel calls out to me, "Mary, don't forget your umbrella." Rachel hands it to me, and it's still wet. I thank her. After an awkward silence, and after Rachel and I say our goodbyes again, it's cold enough that my breath is a visible mist. This is Joy Osmansky. We hoped you have enjoyed this unabridged production of A Head Full of Ghosts by Paul Tremblay. This program was produced by Dion Audio Services. Executive producer, Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2015 by Paul Tremblay. Production copyright 2015 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.